que chasca el Nois Sandino. Desde La Paz hasta Antártica. Poema radial para Kunstradio en Viena.
Estructura del programa.
Vectores. Direcciones desde entidades. La realidad así, contenida en los espacios, se desplaza con mayor o menor fluidez como rayos de luz a través de prismas. Es posible que entonces la realidad se desfase.
I propose that we approach this legal framework critically to think the problem of consent outside of the legal frameworks that tend to dominate public discussions is difficult. At least within public debate in several countries, the problem of consent in conjunction with sexuality is usually understood as a legal problem. For instance, in relation to rape laws, including statutory rape, and debates about differential age of consent laws for men and women, for homosexuality and heterosexuality. There are, by the way, no laws governing age of consent for bisexuals, which means either that bisexuals never consent or that they're completely free. Notes that legal conventions governing equality ended up shaping the discourse of social movements, strengthening the power of several extra-juridical discourses, including medicine, child welfare expertise, social policy, and biomedicine. Indeed, because the equality argument, equality, homosexual, heterosexual, rests on notions of the fixed nature of homosexuality and heterosexuality, psychologists were largely absent from the debate. Maybe that is a good thing, given how dominant perspectives in developmental psychology have surely served the purposes of pathologizing homosexuality and normalizing heterosexuality. Of course, there are all kinds of reasons to resist that new form of pathologization recently installed in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM. I know it's used in Chile as well. But to return to age of consent laws and the grounds of arguing for equality, it's interesting to see that homosexuality had to become a fixed attribute prior to any developmental achievements, and that only once it was considered an immutable characteristic could the equality argument be made. The question is only whether the means through which a justified legal norm is realized also introduces unjustifiable social and cultural norms and even augments their power. In English, when we say libertarian, we're referring to a very specific political philosophy that takes as the most important political ideal individual freedom, as it is expressed in rights of personal expression and the right to private property. Okay, so libertarianism is that form of radical individualism that underwrites and supports laissez-faire capitalism. In 1977-78, Michel Foucault made clear his view that all age of consent laws serve the purposes of regulating norms of decency and criminalizing forms of sexuality. In the past, laws prohibited a number of acts. This is still Foucault. Indeed, acts so numerous one was never quite sure what they were, but nevertheless, it was acts that the law concerned itself with. Certain forms of behavior were condemned. Now what we are defining, and therefore what will be found by the intervention of the law, the judge, and the doctor, are dangerous individuals. We're going to have a society of dangers, with, on the one side, those who are in danger, and on the other, those who are dangerous, end quote. Foucault clearly thought that age of consent laws could only be used to produce a specter of fear, a kind of sex panic that produces greater power for the police and criminalizes sexual freedom. Continuing his reflections on a society of dangers, he wrote, and I quote, "And sexuality will no longer be a kind of behavior hedged in by precise prohibitions, but a kind of roaming danger, a sort of omnipresent phantom, a phantom that will be played out between men and women, children and adults, and possibly between adults themselves, etc. Sexuality will become a threat in all social relations, in all relations between members of different age groups, in all relations between individuals. It is on this shadow, this phantom, this fear, that the authorities would try to get a grip through an apparently generous and at least general legislation and through a series of particular interventions that would probably be made by the legal institutions with the support of the medical institutions," end quote. So-called medical institutions working in coordination with legal systems changed. For Foucault, it was psychiatry, which clearly included psychoanalysis prominently. And in the UK, it was no longer psychiatry, but biomedicine, a social form that Foucault surely anticipated with his conception of biopower, but whose implications for sexual politics of this kind he could not have known.
ruido. Las modulaciones componen esencialmente la radio. La existencia de las frecuencias de las distintas bandas se asemejan a esta realidad descompuesta por el ojo aumentado del enteógeno.
De
la sexualidad
también.
De la sexualidad,
de todo lo mismo. El género
humano. Es como la contra. Kazakhstan. Lucha libre entre el pueblo de China. Nicolás Collins. Judy Butler. Héctor Aguilar. Guarida libre. Juan Manuel Avilés. Lluvia morada. Radio. Mente. Fluido. Realidad.
I have an obsession with the brass band music of the Altiplano from around Cusco. And I've actually done two pieces of music based on this. It's tremendously influential for me. I first heard it in the 1970s. And I did these pieces at the end of the 80s. So it's my history.
We play some coricanta.
No, really?
No,
I would love to, obviously. This would be like heaven. This would be like a dream of mine. I remember the radio station in Cusco when I visited. I was there in 1977. This was before the Sendero Luminoso. And it was on a little street in Cusco. And there was a guy, like he had been selling vegetables in the stand, but he was the radio station. And He had a little record player with a built-in speaker, and he would talk into the mic. And then when he played the record, he'd move the mic down and hold it on above the speaker in the record player. It was so brilliant. And I loved that.
Anfang Oktober 2012 fand in Arequipa, Peru die 8. Ausgabe des Asymmetria Festival für Neuse und experimentelle Musik statt. Es wurden zahlreiche Events wie zum Beispiel Soundlabs, Videoprojektionen, Konzerte und Interventionen in diversen Kunst- und Kulturräumen veranstaltet. Beteiligt waren Soundkünstlerinnen aus Bolivien, Chile und auch Künstlerinnen aus verschiedenen Teilen Perus. Das Festival wurde heuer zum 8. Mal von Marco Valdivia, Admo, kuratiert und geleitet. In den letzten 8 Jahren wurden unter dem Motto Sound-Experimentation zahlreiche internationale Künstlerinnen aus den Vereinigten Staaten von Amerika, Argentinien, Mexiko, Chile und Bolivien unter anderem der Bereiche Bildende Kunst, Rock, Performance und Circuit Bending eingeladen. Das heurige Festival legte einen Schwerpunkt auf Bolivien und lud dazu folgende bolivianische Künstlerinnen ein. Polo Toxico, The Reject Project und mich selbst Juan Spiral. Diese traten gemeinsam mit den Künstlern Vareda Libre, Üblito de China, Luvia Morada und Alvaro Pastor auf. Sonic-Experimentation wird im Allgemeinen von den meisten Menschen nicht besonders geschätzt. Es ist ein Forschungsprozess, der während seiner improvisierten Performance einen Raum erzeugt. Es ist ein Work in Progress als Teil einer ästhetischen Umgebung, einem eigenen Regelwerk folgend, eine einständige Kunst. Das Festival fand als Intervention in den städtischen Raum im Herzen der Stadt Arequipa statt. Eine Kunstgalerie befindet sich gleich neben dem Hauptplatz im historischen Viertel der Stadt. Der Aufbau und die Gestaltung der Konzertsituation in der Galerie wurden von den Teilnehmerinnen mitbestimmt, dadurch entstand eine besondere Atmosphäre, die die Neugier der Passantinnen, sowie die der jungen Neuse-Liebhaberinnen und von Menschen, die sich für diese Ästhetik interessieren, auf sich zog.
Thank you.
Die gemeinsamen Eindrücke während des Events waren ebenso interessant wie die präsentierten unterschiedlichen künstlerischen Positionen. Diese reichten von Haarschnäuse über postapokalyptisches Dröhnen und Donnern bis hin zu eher kontemplativen Formen wie zum Beispiel meditative Performances. Die Veranstaltung zeigte die unterschiedlichen und die teils ähnlichen Zugänge der Künstlerinnen aus den verschiedenen Ländern und Regionen auf. Die Künstlerinnen konnten sich besser kennenlernen und erklärten sich solidarisch miteinander. Eines der interessantesten Ergebnisse war das sogenannte Carrascanoise, ein Zusammenspiel aller Künstlerinnen des Festivals. Diese gemeinsame Performance wurde in der unabhängigen Kunstresidenz Estación Tomadahal öffentlich veranstaltet. Alle Künstler benutzen dasselbe Mischpult und improvisierten auf fast rituelle Art und Weise miteinander. Noise als ästhetische Bewegung stellt viele Fragen zur Unabhängigkeit von Kultur und Kunst. Ihre Vertreter produzieren ihre Alben und Stücke in Eigenregie und stellen diese im virtuellen Raum zur Verfügung und bieten kostenlose Downloads an. Live-Performances und Konzerte finden in der Regel in verschiedenen Räumen und Kontexten statt. Diese reichen von Punkkonzerten oder anderen Genres über kulturelle Veranstaltungen, Familienfeiern und Straßenfesten. Nach der Vorstellung des peruanischen Künstlers Marco Valdivia sollte Noise auf das Publikum von oben herab losgelassen werden. Das jährliche Festival Asymmetria ist bereits gut in den entsprechenden künstlerischen Szenen und innerhalb der Stadt Arequipa, aber auch in Lima und in anderen südamerikanischen Städten bekannt. Die Umsetzung des Festivals ist ein ernstzunehmendes Ereignis, vor allem weil ständig versucht wird, das Konzept des Noise und dessen Bedeutung neu zu überdenken, zu strukturieren und zu hinterfragen. Allerdings haben einige Vertreter des Noise die Einstellung, dass Noise die Subkultur und den Untergrund nicht verlassen bzw. nicht darüber hinausgehen darf. Die Budgets müssen gering oder nicht vorhanden sein. Die Idee, mit Noise Geld zu verdienen, gilt als verwerflich. Sie wollen auch keine Workshops und andere Aktivitäten veranstalten, die der Verbreitung dienen, und betrachten Noise nicht als Kunstform oder als Musik. Es ist wahr, dass in unserem kapitalistischen System Kunst nur ein Konsumprodukt darstellt. Die Institution Kunst ist ein Ergebnis der Maschinerie des Kapitalismus. Diese Maschine entscheidet, was Kultur ist und welche künstlerische Aktivitäten einen kulturellen Wert für die Bevölkerung darstellen. In den letzten 10 Jahren habe ich als Künstler die Kunstwelt mit ihren Institutionen, Kuratoren und Kulturmanagern erlebt und kennengelernt. Es kommt häufig vor, dass ich Menschen treffe, die meine Arbeit für wertlos halten. Während des Asymmetria-Festival haben wir darüber diskutiert, wie man einem breiteren Publikum die Ideen von freier Kultur, Recycling und von der Dezentralisierung von Informationen näher bringen kann. Denn Information soll sich nicht nur auf die etablierten Orte, Szenen und Bereiche beschränken. Das Ziel eines jeden Künstlers, der seine Arbeit ernst nimmt, ist es, ein bewusst denkendes und möglichst großes Publikum aufzubauen. Die Zusammenarbeit mit Institutionen und Organisationen ist aber eine von vielen Möglichkeiten, die aber stets gewissenhaft und mit einer kritischen Haltung einhergehen muss. Ein Wochenende mit den Viren des Systems zu verbringen, war sehr angenehm und eine bereichernde Erfahrung. Wochen später konnte ich noch mehr von der Szene in Arequipa miterleben und stand gemeinsam mit Fiorella 16 Metern der Noise-Szene auf der schönsten unterirdischen Bühne, nämlich in der Stadtgarage El Vejo. Somit hat das Festival Asymmetria auch dazu gedient, einen Motor zum Laufen zu bringen. Asymmetria ist ein wichtiges Festival und Ereignis, denn Noise ist eine Herausforderung für die etablierten ästhetischen Werte. Mein Interesse gilt dem Einsatz von veralteten Technologien und dem Recycling von elektrischen Spielzeug- und Videospielkonsolen als Signalgeneratoren.
Extreme, you have like a trained opera singer who can stand in the middle of the stage of a huge concert hall and open her mouth, and it's the loudest thing you've ever heard in your life. It's like a jet plane taking off. I mean, it's beautiful, but it's incredibly loud. That's dynamic range. And you think about what we can do with our hands. You think about the range of resolution you have with your hand when you go to say draw something on a piece of paper with a pencil, from the very finest motion up to, you know, making graffiti on the side of a building. This is an incredible range of movement. And I think that the most expressive of traditional musical instruments are ones that try very, very hard to come close to that sense of response and range. I think maybe the best example would be, say, bowed stringed instruments, like violin, cello, double bass, where you have that fine nuance of tiny motions that are just like vibrato or a very small change in tuning. And then you've got the big motions of, say, bowing or doing a glissando. But a potentiometer on a mixer is so crude, yeah, compared to that. And then if you have to digitize that in a computer program, and you're saying, oh, well, it's not so important to just the loudness of a mix. We can just use 8 bits to define this. You're throwing away everything that the human body has evolved to do with infinite nuance, right? And I think that maybe in 99% of all circumstances, we can be happy with a very, very crude dynamic range. I can either talk or shut up. two states. But if I want to sing to you, I can't do it in two states. I have to use everything in between, or you're not going to believe anything I sing, right? And I think that, a lot of interfaces don't let you sing. They quantize you. And some of these cruder systems that some artists are interested in are an attempt to get at that nuance. I like working with my students, but it's very seldom that I hear something that I say, wow, that's completely different. You know, that's really new. I don't hear new things. And in the last couple of years, I've started to hear new things again. And it's these movements that I think come out of the improvised music world more than out of composed music or pop music. And it's a kind of a new style of free improvisation or open form improvisation that works with some electronics, but at a very low level. It's not about using effect pedals, it's about using a compact mic or some big feedback. It sounds stupid when I talk about it, but it really is just subtly different in a way that I find quite interesting. There's been in post-jazz improvised music, if we can use that term, say, to describe anything from like the free music movements in Germany and London from the late 1970s, 1980s. From that point on, there's been a very different idea about improvisation that some people have embraced, and that is anti-virtuosic. Okay, but I think that traditionally in jazz, in most indigenous musics, even in rock and roll, there's been the idea that the longer you play, the better you will get. And you will achieve a mastery of certain things in whatever defines mastery in your tradition. You know, if you're playing blues, there are certain references. If you're playing jazz, there are certain references. If you're playing rock and roll, there are certain things that a good player can do and a bad player cannot yet do. And I think that what happened in a lot of free improvisation was there is an attempt to welcome the mistake and the accident. And I think this is a kind of a post-Cage, post-Robert Rauschenberg idea about the way art works, that accidents and noise have as equal a role as intentionality and self-expression. Maybe one of the things that's appealing about working with certain technology is that there's some technology that's very difficult to control. You know, think about feedback between a mic and a speaker. You know, you know it's either happening or it's not, but it's very difficult to say, I want to play the Blue Danube waltz in feedback, right? So you have this degree of uncontrollability. And maybe that's part of what I like when I hear this use of electronics, this sort of low-level electronics in improvisation. And I may be projecting, but that may be what the players also like, is that idea that it's difficult to control. Are an attempt to get at that nuance. I think noise is part of that resolution, right? I mean, I think that noise is a way of saying I'm interested in all the micro detail. You know, I'm not talking about a clean transition from on to off. I'm talking about an infinite gradation of fluctuations of energy. Certain older electronic technology probably has more of that resolution in it because it's simpler. It's not it's not coupling one thing to another. Like a contact mic is like a fingernail, and you can do anything with it you can do with your fingernail. It's not like a computer. Feedback is another thing. You know, feedback is a lot like a violin in the sense that if you have a microphone and a speaker, you can move the mic a fraction of a millimeter, or you can move the, you can throw the mic across the room. You know, it's all part of the same system of movement. So I think that's why there are these very, very elemental things that perhaps attract artists who are interested in noise. La futura eso. Yeah, I would be very hesitant to map my instincts and feelings onto anyone else. I'm very conscious of the fact that the generation of composers who are my teachers or mentors or influences, I can name them. You know, I studied with Alvin Lucier when I was in university. He brought in all of his friends to do workshops with us. So I worked with David Behrman. I worked with David Tudor. We had Pauline Oliveros visit. You know, we had Robert Ashley come and do residencies. John Cage came. These were people who I knew, I met when I was very young in the 70s, and I continued to have relationships with for a long time. Plus my own generation of artists and people a little older than me, like John Bischoff and Chris Brown, who are out at Mills College, Tim Perkis, Paul DeMarinis, these early computer music composers who were very important. Ron Quibolo, who was a student of mine when I was, a student with me when I was at Westman. And the thing is that when I look at Lucier's generation, I see a group of artists who had their lives turned upside down by John Cage. These were Americans for whom Cage represented a tremendous liberation, but at the same time, trauma, because neurosis, because they had studied at conservatory, and they were good little music students, and they had a decision to make after they heard Cage, which is either they would just kind of like toughen up and keep writing what they always were writing, or they would reject so much of what they'd learned and try to do something new. Now, it's very, very difficult to wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to do something new. It's much easier to say, I'm going to keep working on what I started working on yesterday. Okay? So a lot of these artists had, you know, tremendous anxiety. They stopped writing music for months. You know, every one of them has a very beautiful story about that transition. And then they experimented, not in the scientific sense, but in the sense that it's known in the art world, which is they just kept trying different things. You know, Alvin Lucier made a piece about the way bats navigate in space with sound. It had nothing to do with music in the sense of making rhythms or melodies. It had to do with the idea of sound as a survival instinct, right? Or you had David Behrman doing very early music with electronic circuits where he just sort of let these circuits behave and do what they wanted to do on their own rather than try to control them and structure them in a form like, say, a German or French electronic music composer at the time would have done. You had Phil Glass taking counterpoint back to the very first rule of counterpoint, no parallel fifths, and violating it to say, let's write a piece only in parallel fifths. I mean, these are the kind of experiments that they were making. And that's when I was a student, when all of this was wide open. And so I thought, and my friends thought, the future of music is to endlessly experiment. But you know what? The best of the composers of my mentor's generation, like Lucier and Ashley and Phil Glass, they ended up, by the year 2000, with a very, very distinct, very specific style. Their music doesn't change 180 degrees from one composition to the next in 2013 the way it did in 1973. They used that period of experimentation to find a style, It's the only way I can describe it, to find their personal style. And I think that that's a very powerful lesson. Because I think it's very easy to be distracted just by the idea. It's like, you know, the notion in China of continuous revolution. You know, it doesn't always work out. Oh, absolutely. I think that is what's happened. That is what's happened. I think where I started was to say, I wouldn't want to try to guess what, say, the electronic music composers who were my influences would think or say about noise music as it is practiced today. Every one of them, as we say in colloquial English, flirted with noise. Okay? I think in the aftermath of Cage, every composer that I know of as an American had to deal with two materials that have been ignored by music for a long time. One is noise, and the other is silence. And every one of them elevated one of those two elements in one or more pieces of music to a high level. Think about it. I mean, music for solo performer is kind of like Varese's ionization, you know, updated in the manner of speaking. You know, this is percussion music played by brainwaves. The sounds of Vespers are just these little clicks, these little ticks, which a lot of people would dismiss as being noise. And huge amounts of silences in both of those pieces. But, and David Tudor's electronic material had a huge amount of noise. You know, there was like, he loved rich, rich, dense, complex sounds at a time when there was a lot of minimalist music floating around. It was very clean and very modal. Here's my personal theory about noise. My personal theory about noise music is that there was surely a very strong movement in the 1980s coming out of Japan in particular of noise music. And then at the end of the 90s, there was a revival. It was like there was another wave of noise music from Japan, from Korea, from a lot of other countries. And I think that the first wave of noise music in Japan had some connection to the punk ethos and a certain kind of nihilism that I think what was very much part of Japanese youth culture in the 80s, just because of the amount of rigidity that the culture had. But in the end of the 90s, I think that the next wave of noise came out of a change in the way younger people perceived time, which is that I think that what happened around the time of YouTube, where suddenly videos went from being 30 minutes long to being 30 seconds long, and television commercials started to have many more edits in them in 5 seconds than your average Hollywood film would have in 5 minutes, is that we had an accelerated sense of change and time. And I think that we had a generation emerge that could simply process data much faster. Video games would be another example. I mean, the speed with which things happen in computer gaming kept increasing, getting faster and faster and faster. So I think what happened was, just like planes get faster and cars get faster, I think that the processing, I think people got used to processing data faster. And here's the thing. Something that sounds like noise when it's slow, if you listen to it very quickly, you perceive the structure within it. Okay? So I think that a lot of noise music that came out, say, after the year 2000, is microstructured music that a lot of people can't hear. Older people in particular can't hear. For my generation, this was the way our parents dismissed rock and roll. They said, it's just noise. Every generation says that the next generation's music is just noise. And I think a lot of it has to do not with shh versus but it has to do with the rate of change. Compared to a Beethoven symphony, a Chuck Berry pop song, which is 2 minutes long, it's faster. Things change much more quickly, and it's over faster. That's a very good point, and I will admit, I have I regard the presence or absence of the beat as like a very, very fundamental defining aspect of music. And I, for one, have very, very seldom used a beat in my music. And the few times I have, it has always been thwarted. That is, it never remains steady. It always gets interrupted. And for me, it's never about the beat or the pulse. It's always about the interruption. And it's why, as my children say, in this world, Daddy, there are makers and there are breakers. And you will always be a breaker, and you will never figure out how to make money doing what you do. And I said, okay, that's... Well, I mean, that's a very sort of Cage thing, right? I mean, I think what Cage admired about noise with a small n, you know, as say, like, non-intentionally produced sound, was that it was stripped of intention, that you couldn't assume that if I opened this door to the cafe and admit the outside sound, you can't assume it'll have the same message, intentional message, that the music that's playing over the jukebox here right now has. In other words, what's coming into my left ear has been designed to convey a message, and what's coming into my right ear is not. What's coming into my right ear from the outside of the cafe is simply the byproduct of human activity, collectively. And it doesn't have any more message other than the fact that we're in an urban environment. So, pop music of the late 60s and 70s made people aware of was the physical character of sound. In Western culture, we had a very, for too many years, we had a very abstract sort of non-body relationship to music that's quite different from most cultures. Mm-hmm. But I think that amplification reintroduced the physicality of sound to a lot of people. And everything from the sort of psychedelic era use of high sound pressure combined with drugs to probably more significantly the evolution of disco and dance music. It was about the sound pressure levels that, you know, you could get with a good sound system in a club, and obviously using music for sort of slightly more trance-inducing qualities than you would have gotten, say, listening to any music over a radio in the early 1960s. I mean, it's a very different thing. I think a lot of the noise music from, say, the Japanese epoch of the 80s down has used the sort of outward aggressive quality of it to convey very specific, you know, sort of like emotional states. I don't suppose it's any different than, you know, someone, certain inflections in blues vocals or, you know, the kind of shouting you get in an Aretha Franklin song in terms of expressing, you know, certain emotional states. I guess that in noise music, it was stripped back from a lot of the conventional tools that people used in music to convey emotion. It wasn't based on, you know, certain types of chords evoking particular responses or certain lyrics necessarily. And it was simply the assaultive qualities of very high sound pressure noise. Yeah.
Traditional figure of the artist, you are...
Maybe, but I think there are a lot of repressed composers. I'm certainly not the only one who needs psychoanalysis to get out of a box. You know what I mean? I think that's one of the hallmarks of so-called serious music, is that little bit of restraint. You know, as you listen to the music coming out of conservatories at the time at Motown and Stax and Tamla were all producing these wonderful R&B songs that all of the world was responding to. And we were talking about a very, very cool, unemotional music that was being produced by people who called themselves composers. Yeah, so I think that's, I don't know that.
¿Y ahora qué? ¿Vayan a volver a San Luis?
¿Nunca dejó a San
Luis? El ruido se sitúa más allá de la música y más allá del estilo. La radio se sitúa más allá de la realidad y la mente es más otros que yo.
We'll be right back.
it's appealing about working with certain technology is that there's some technology that's very difficult to control.